Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 19, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Today we welcome our experts, Daniel Horowitz, who's the author of Stolen Sovereignty, moderating the call is Eileen J. O'Connor, who's the founder of the Law Office of Eileen J. O'Connor, PLLC. Thank you to both our experts for joining us today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lee.
Thank you, Tim. There's a lot of static on the line if it's at your end. I just want to warn you. Welcome all. On behalf of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group, I'm glad that you're able to attend our teleforum conference to discuss, as Tim said, Daniel E. Horowitz's book, Stolen Sovereignty. I found the book so impressive for so many reasons. Those of you who are going about your lives, tending to your business, and you look at the daily news or what's happening in the courts, and you go slightly bonkers, and you want to write something about it, I'm happy to report that very often when I read, in fact, always when I read Daniel Horowitz's stuff, it reminds me of Liza Minnelli, who was the daughter of Judy Garland. Judy Garland, you might be too young to know, was in The Wizard of Oz, decades and decades ago, and sang Over the Rainbow. Whenever Liza Minnelli was asked to sing that song, she replied, "It's been sung." And I feel that way. Daniel Horowitz takes the events of the day, applies wisdom and knowledge and foresight, gathers them all together, and when you read his writing, you say to yourself, yes, you don't have to write it. Daniel has done it in so much better than you would have. In his book, Stolen Sovereignty, Daniel does a number of things. He brings together all, not all, but so many of the things that you have been reading about and probably fretting about. And also, and this is something that's of personal significance to me, I had the privilege of being friends with Bob Bork, who wrote, among other things, Slouching Toward Gomorrah, Coercing Virtue, and in the magazine First Things, The End of Democracy. These books all go back to the mid-1990s. Actually, one of them is even earlier than that. But in Stolen Sovereignty, what Daniel Horowitz does is brings forward to today how what Robert Bork warned about those decades ago has come to fruition. Because he has so much to talk to us about as he describes some of the content of his book. Without further ado, I give you Daniel Horowitz.
Well, it's really an honor, Eileen O'Connor, for inviting me to this prestigious forum. And I must say, I kind of feel like Cinderella here. You gave the shout out to the Wizard of Oz. I'm probably the only one on the call without a law degree. I'm just kind of a political guy. Nothing special, you know, among a whole group of scholars and legal eagles, right-leaning conservative legal scholars. And this is just really an honor of a lifetime to be able to address you, to be able to talk about my book, some of my side writings. If some of you know or don't know, at a Conservative Review, I write every day about all the political issues of our time. But in addition, I've really written a lot about the courts, probably more so since my book came out 2 months ago than the entire length of my book, because unfortunately the thesis of my book seems to have been proven true just in watching some of the things the lower courts have done the last couple of months. You know, as my friend Andy McCarthy said when I embarked on this, and I said, look, you know, everyone's going to laugh at me. I don't even have a law degree here. I'll say, well, you know, that's kind of a good thing. That way, the common sense is not contaminated by all the funny case law we've had over the last couple hundred years. You could just take a look at the Constitution, what's actually going on and where we're headed. And that's really what I want to give over in the short period of time we have together. I really want to turn up the heat. Obviously, judicial tyranny, judicial activism is a conversation, gosh, everyone on our side has been having for a half a century. But on some level, that's the point. We've been having this conversation for a half a century, and it progressively gets worse and worse and worse. And it's almost like we have the same conversations, and we're stuck in neutral. We don't really change the name of the game. And really, kind of a reflection of the political branches of government, where things are progressively getting more progressive, more liberal, more left-leaning. It's the same thing with the courts, with the judiciary, except obviously the consequences are so much graver, because when things are enacted through the judiciary, they are taken away from the people, and there really is no remedy. Or is there a remedy? And that's really what I'd like to discuss. In all candor, despite promoting my book for 2 months, I haven't gotten any better in making it quicker or concise, because this is such a broad book with many different facets: religious liberty, marriage, immigration, sovereignty, birthright, citizenship, and obviously all wrapped around the judiciary. And really what the thesis of this book is, in honor of Justice Scalia's aphorism that he coined in the Obergefell case, what we're confronted with today is something much greater, much graver, of much greater consequence than what our founders were confronted with. They're confronted with taxation without representation. We're confronted, to paraphrase Justice Scalia, we're confronted with social transformation without representation. That's really what I'd like to discuss today. Last week I put out, in honor of Constitution Day, a manifesto viewed at conservativereview.com, and I really touch on the fact that if you look at its core, the constitutional crisis we face, which is multifaceted, but the single biggest problem is this: social transformation without representation. That whereas the states were supposed to be dominant in all but international affairs and peace and war, and within the federal government, the people's representatives, the Congress, in the words of Madison, was to necessarily predominate in a Republican form of government, it's been flipped on its head. The states are crushed, they're meaningless, and the judiciary and the executive agencies control the federal government. And that's the social transformation without representation. So just kind of delving into the title of the book, Stolen Sovereignty, is almost like a double entendre. It's that the individual sovereignty, the sovereignty of the individual in the state, has been stolen by the courts in terms of pursuing self-governance. But then also, which is really kind of the du jour issue with the lead up in my book and the capstone of the book, is the final frontier of judicial tyranny, as I call it. And that's the stolen sovereignty, international sovereignty, the sovereignty of our federal union. What I warn about: the coming of judicial amnesty, granting rights, citizen rights, to illegal immigrants, eventually citizenship. So this is really a multifaceted book, but I want to kind of drill down and zoom out a little bit to why I wrote this book, why I feel a sense of urgency. For me, what was the cathartic moment, and what I hope would be for our entire movement, and some of the remedies I discussed, both mechanically or at least in spirit, that I feel we need to imbue in the public dialogue and at least get on the table, that they are options, that ultimately Congress and the people and the states do have the power. They need to take back that power, and how we could do it, at least as it relates to the judiciary. Now, I go back to really last year, last June, the marriage case. I'm still in utter shock that this wasn't a cathartic moment for the entire right of center movement. Chapter 3 of my book is the entire philosophical, legal takedown, constitutional takedown of the Obergefell case, and the consequences, the religious liberty consequences. And I never bring up religion or whether homosexuality is a sin or the greatest thing known to man or anything in between. But just noting the consequences of that decision, and how, to me, I step back and thought, we literally redefine the building block of all civilization from the unelected branch of government, thereby precluding states from even defining it as it has been since the dawn of time. The consequences certainly being the religious liberty issues. We're now seeing the codification of transgenderism. And there really was no movement that it spawned, kind of what we saw in the backside of Roe v. Wade. And then on September 3rd, I start out the book with, to me, that should be a day that will live on in infamy, and it's lost on everyone, what happened on September 3rd. I made the following juxtaposition. On the very same day, Kim Davis was thrown in jail for merely peacefully asserting her religious liberty rights. She was clerk of the county, deputy clerk and clerk there for 30 years, long before the concept of a same-sex marriage even crystallized for the first time in 2001 in the Netherlands. And she was thrown in jail for it's not that she barricaded the doors, didn't let anyone in, didn't allow anyone to take her place. She just said, look, I can't do this. And she was thrown in jail by a Republican-appointed judge who issued the order and laughed at her when she talked about natural law, which is the source of all inalienable rights mentioned in the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. It's also, as a side note, a funny thing. I live in Baltimore, Maryland, and that was around the same time that the protesters in the Freddie Gray case were given space to destroy. And that was viewed as kind of a political protest, even though it got violent. And we've always had this tradition in our country that even if you disagree, even if ultimately you kind of break the law, you would never throw someone in jail. And indeed, they didn't do it there. But here, someone upholding the most literal sense of natural law, Kentucky law that was upheld since since it was brought into the federal union, and it was reinforced by 3/4 of the voters in the state. She was thrown in jail. On the very same day, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals invalidated a deportation of a 2-time criminal alien and almost killed people in a drunk driving incident, asserted that the individual was transgendered, applied international law saying the person would be tortured if they were to be returned to Mexico, and then went on to castigate the ICE officials for not using the proper pronoun. And to me, that was kind of the Houston, we've got a problem moment. On the very same day, the sovereignty and security of a nation was violated. The Constitution was supplanted for international law. Peaceful adherence to state law and religious liberty, deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition, were criminalized. At the same time, transgenderism, the most grotesque contortion of natural law was codified into law. And policy, and homosexual marriage was prioritized over religious liberty, all at the hands of the unelected branch of government that, in the words of Hamilton, was to have neither force nor will. And it was at that point I said to myself, haven't we crossed the Rubicon? We keep saying, well, we don't want Democrats to win the next election. They might really make the courts very liberal. Hasn't that already happened? And then concurrently, and this might seem kind of a little bit off topic, but it's really the same topic and tied into my book, I observed a long train of abuses and usurpations at the lower court level. What I call the final frontier of judicial tyranny, the sovereignty of the nation itself. They're gradually granting rights to illegal immigrants, overturning not just state immigration enforcement, but federal immigration statutes, which, as I note, I have a chapter in the book, chapter 4, where I go through 100 years of case law that Justice Felix Frankfurter noted was the most inviolable of all settled law, that Congress has full power over immigration, that the people through their elected representatives, this is rooted in the preamble of the Declaration, popular sovereignty, you have the right to decide who comes into your country, under what circumstances, until they're naturalized. You could do with them whatever you want, except for obviously indefinitely detain them, but you could deport them for any reason. And this has just been violated across the board. Again, immigration, disparate impact that happened the same week as the marriage case. Obviously what they did with Obamacare, literally rewriting statutes from the bench. You're seeing the nightmare scenario of what some of the people who came before us warned about. We're no longer slouching towards Gomorrah. We are in it. This is the worst form of social transformation without representation. And the funny thing is, since I wrote my book, you always wonder, well, are you making too big of a deal out of what's going on? Just since late July when my book was published, in no specific order, just off the top of my head, and I've written dozens of articles at Conservative Review on each of these cases, the courts have codify transgenderism into various parts of the 14th Amendment and Title VII of the Civil Rights. They've mandated funding for Planned Parenthood, a private organization under criminal investigation for harvesting baby organs, but at the same time, forcing private entities to service things that are against their conscience, overriding state religious liberty laws, literally decimating the most basic state election laws. You're seeing this obviously now the last couple of weeks, mandating early voting. The 14th Amendment now creates a right to early voting. All sorts of voting anomalies, preventing states from demanding we show voter ID, mandating that states give birth certificates to those who don't show valid forms of ID. Again, this is gets to the core of stolen sovereignty. It's not just kind of judicial activism, you know, that they're codifying the Democrat political agenda into law. It's that they're, number one, rendering all elections moot by becoming the final arbiter of every social and political issue of our time. But worse, they're actually going to prevent those of us, especially on the right-leaning side of the political spectrum, from ever winning elections because of this stolen sovereignty, because of, you know, preventing states from upholding the integrity of the franchise. You know, non-citizens voting, that was a case that came out just last week with Kansas. Preventing states, even with an agreement from federal officials to ask for proof of citizenship to register to vote. And literally the sovereignty of the people being stolen, every social issue being turned on its head. This to me was the impetus to write this book, that I felt this notion that, oh, we're going to just appoint better judges when Republicans get in there. We've been saying that for 50 years. This is a very long discussion, but I would just point anyone who wants to see for further reading. If they don't want to read a whole book, I have maybe just a 3,000-word essay, 12 Reasons Why the Federal Judiciary is Irremediably Broken, and just really addressing this specific point, why I believe it's never going to be enough to just merely attempt to appoint better judges when we're in power. Not to say that, you know, when we are in power and have that prerogative, we shouldn't work together. And Federalist Society does an amazing job at that, to try to inform, you know, senators and potential president of the best potential picks out there. But, you know, to quote Alito in the Obergefell case, what is evidence is the deep and perhaps irremediable corruption of our legal culture's conception of constitutional interpretation. I would agree with everything except for the word perhaps. I mean, I think it's very clear, and certainly this all gets back to a mixture of the at-bats, what I call the at-bats, which side gets 90% of the at-bats in court. So it's the control of the legal profession, the ACLU, the NAACP. These groups have the ability to put every single state law, even if the state law is the most common sense exercise of plenary state power or near plenary power over a given issue, such as methods and procedures for elections, whether it's immigration enforcement, which Congress has plenary power over, whether it's turning natural law on its head. I was talking with Eileen last week, and I was joking around with her. I said, if you look at our legal structure now, it basically comes out that two consenting adults cannot engage in conversion therapy. If someone engages in homosexual behavior, wants to convert back, that's outlawed most places. It is therefore considered more natural for a man to be homosexual than for a man to be a man. In other words, it's permissible for a doctor to perform a sex change operation and literally mutilate someone's body, but someone cannot engage in consensual, you know, contractual work to do conversion therapy. I mean, the source of all inalienable rights have been flipped on its head. And this is why I believe it's so systemic, so irremediable. Again, the legal profession, the people that put all these cases in court, the convoluted rules of standing, where I really demonstrate that with immigration, it's very evident because states, law enforcement agencies, and individual taxpayers can never get standing to sue when states or federal executive agencies manifestly violate congressional immigration enforcement statutes. Yet illegal aliens, refugee resettlement contract groups, you're seeing this just last week in the Seventh Circuit, all over the place, they get standing to demand funding to bring in more foreign nationals. But a state is completely left out to dry. They cannot get standing, even when the president or other agencies legitimately violate congressional immigration statutes. So it's the standing. I mean, Judge Robert Rogers Brown noted this in a D.C. case. Everyone's focused on DAPA, but DACA was upheld because the lawsuit from the ICE agents and the state of Mississippi was thrown out. And she lamented this fact that the sheriff of Maricopa County, the largest jurisdiction on the border, one of the largest jurisdictions in the country, flooded with all the problems as a result of Obama refusing to enforce the law, there's nothing they can do. They don't get standing. So again, and this is a big part of what I hope to get to in the remaining time, why I believe stripping the courts down to size, swinging the pendulum back to congressional and state control more than the judiciary, we're not going to, all the ancillary benefits you might point to that we had, going after liberal legislative laws through the courts, going on offense, we're very rarely on offense. And the few times we are, we often don't get standing. When we do, they're very narrow victories. It's so much more irremediable the other way. And again, so the rules of standing, the lower courts, which make Anthony Kennedy look like James Madison, on a Supreme Court level, a train of observations I've been seeing with all but Thomas and Alito unwilling to grant cert or issue a temporary stay on all these insane lower court rulings. And then finally, the 14th Amendment itself, in conjunction with what I call one-directional stare decisis. So let's discuss immigration, which is a big part of the book. I really explore judicial tyranny through the prism of sovereignty, immigration enforcement. You have 100 years of case law really addressing the most sacred parts of the Declaration of Independence, of what it means to be a nation state, governance by the consent of the governed, that the people through their elected representatives have full control over this issue. And again, Justice Frankfurter would say that there's not merely a page, but a chapter, but an entire volume of settled law on this notion. And yet, over the last generation, it started a little bit with Plyler v. Doe, Justice Brennan, but is really taken on a life of its own, and then with Zavidas in 2001, and now it's just, you look in the lower courts, I mean, I literally believe if nothing is done about this, we will have judicial amnesty straight up, equal protection, substantive due process, done, 14th Amendment, and it's turned on its head. The left is willing to lie, cheat, and steal, so to speak, I'm exaggerating a little bit, don't quote me on it, in order to achieve their outcomes-based jurisprudence. They will overturn the most settled law. But then once that's done, our side, for the most part, there's very few Clarence Thomases around, they'll accept that as settled law. And they'll look at you like you're from Mars if you invoke the early 1870s, 1880 cases interpreting the first aspects of the 14th Amendment, whether it's privileges and immunities, due process, equal protection, or the citizenship clause as it relates to birthright citizenship and whether that would apply to people who are here against the consent of the nation. I believe there's enough existing nuclear 14th Amendment jurisprudence to destroy our republic seven times over, even if we don't expand upon it. And again, you're seeing that already there with the transgenderism, with there's now a 14th Amendment right to vote early. And again, I'm just kind of jumping a little bit from one issue to another to demonstrate this thesis. But, you'll have a Democrat panel that will go with whatever the Democrat Party Soros election agenda wants. So if they want 25 days of early voting, there's a constitutional right, 14th Amendment, even 15th Amendment right, certainly the VRA, right to 25 days of early voting. You'll get a Republican panel that, well, we won't yet go 25 days. This was the golden week in Ohio in the Sixth Circuit, the one defensive victory we got recently. But, you know, they'll go 10 days. They'll go with these anomalies. And all of this is manifestly against the Constitution, and yet they're saying it's mandated by the 14th Amendment. And it is just – it's simply astounding that we've allowed it to go this far. I believe that were Hillary to win, I think everyone's going to start to come around to my way of thinking on the hopelessness of the courts. But I wrote this book, you know, beginning, like I said, last fall, with the hope and understanding that a Republican would be president given the weakness of the Democrat candidate. And I believe it still holds true. It will take years to turn over what Obama has done. Obama, you know, you've seen a lot of this number bantied about that he's appointed 40% of the district bench, about 33% of the appellate bench. 9 of the 13 circuits are majority Democrat appointee. But again, I mean, the Seventh Circuit, my personal opinion, that's still majority Republican. But oh my gosh, I mean, it's certainly not originalist. And, you know, we couldn't even get a voter ID law passed the Fifth Circuit with a majority Republican panel there. Maybe the Eighth Circuit's still good. There really isn't much left there. And I just kind of game out. I don't spend too much time on this in the book, but if you look demographically, circuit by circuit, the active judges, the senior judges, a lot of Reagan judges retiring, and just the ages circuit by circuit, I agree with Linda Hirschman's assessment that Obama really did a number. Really, really did a number on this. It's very hard to imagine in 4 years. You know, certainly if you look in a vacuum, is it better if a Republican wins than a Democrat wins? Yeah, it's always better. But it's the fundamentals are there. The fundamentals with the built-in precedent, the 14th Amendment codification of disparate impact. And I don't just mean the Texas disparate impact proper, as the term is used, but I mean, just broadly speaking, anytime the NAACP could point to a state law and say, well, you know, if you have voting for 24 hours for 6 Sundays before an election, more blacks will turn out. Well, yeah, I mean, you can't deny that. So therefore, that's guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. I mean, this type of stuff is already there. It's already terminal. We might win a couple more defensive victories. But the way I view it with the courts is almost as if the other side has a first and goal at our 1 yard line with an unlimited number of shots. Once in a while, we could still get there. And I think this is why some people are kind of tantalized by the fact that, you see 4-4 cases sometimes. Oh, well, Kennedy is still with us with here, you know, this case. Roberts is still with us. But the way I view it is that, yeah, the courts hang in the balance in terms of they hang in the balance between tranche 20 and tranche 21 into post-constitutional Sodom and Gomorrah, whereas the Republican judges will take it to 20 or at least tolerate 20. Democrats will take it to infinity. But we are so far gone. And again, the Democrats will just pick it up where they left. Before just going to – and I can't believe time has flown by so quickly. I'm trying to – kind of speak as fast as I can. But before we get to just what I want to talk about, the remedy Article 3, Section 2, and just broadly what it represents, I want to kind of defend the agenda to return the power to the people, to the legislature, to the states. You know, I hear sometimes, well, you know, we benefited from the courts in certain cases. If you look every time we benefit from the courts, they are so narrow, they're so fleeting when we go on offense, and they're so rare. I picture Hobby Lobby with religious liberty, Heller, the VRA case, Shelby County, and some of these regulatory cases. You know, you look at if you just juxtapose Heller to Obergefell, you know, that's one case. We went on offense, they went on offense. And again, I hear a lot of people say, "Oh my gosh, we're going to lose our gun rights if Hillary wins." And the reality is, since years after Heller, and again, something manifestly written in the Constitution, you shouldn't need Heller for this. you literally have states chipping away at it. Every blue state has some sort of assault weapons ban. I live in Maryland. I still cannot carry any sort of weapon of any caliber, of any type. And every single circuit has upheld it. And I know Thomas and Alito did call out the other justices for denying cert from the plaintiffs appealing these cases. But here we are. I mean, they're getting away with it. And that's the thing. The left doesn't give up. They don't just take it. They'll move on. And they have either in the blue states, they have the political will and cojones to do what it takes. Or in the red states, they have the legal profession and the lower courts to force the red states to do it. And, you know, you look at Shelby County. I mean, that was just the pre-clearance provision of Section 4B, I believe. But, you know, look at what's going on, the disaster over the last couple of months. The VRA has been used to throw out every common sense election law or roll back some of the most egregious Democrat voting anomalies of the last decade. And again, you juxtapose that to Obergefell, and okay, here we are. The foundation of all civilization is redefined, done. And then immediately, all 50 states, more or less, no one challenged the contours. States say, hey, well, maybe we'll do this, not in every case, and force them to take them to court. No, I mean, they got it. The left got what they want. Our side falls apart. Hobby Lobby, what happened to religious liberty? It's in tatters now. Mississippi's law was overturned. North Carolina was taken to court. And again, just a note here, they all get standing to sue because they're offended by a certain policy, even though it doesn't affect a fundamental right. They're not being thrown in jail. Just the opposite. It's our side that's being thrown in jail for adhering to their property and conscience rights. So we really haven't gotten too much benefit in the scheme of things, certainly when juxtaposed to the destruction. And that's what I seek to give over in layman's terms, because heck, I am a layman. I am a political guy, not so much a legal guy. And wanted to give over to people the role of the courts, the historical role of it, what it was meant to do, what the judiciary was tasked with doing, what they weren't tasked to do, and even to the extent they've usurped power, what Congress can do to take it back. And, you know, Article 3, Section 2 is very clear. There's an exemptions and regulations clause. And I know other people have mentioned it. I know other people have scoffed at it. And I know people in the past have given reasons, well, lack of uniformity in law, because then all the state courts will make their own decisions. All sorts of different things. Well, I don't know. We don't want to declare war on the courts. If what has happened over the last number of years is not the impetus for it, I don't know what is. To just say either, oh man, we need to enact a constitutional amendment defining marriage or defining sexuality as a man's a man, a woman's a woman, or allowing Congress and states to enforce immigration laws. No, they are the ones who are engaging in civil disobedience. They are the ones that are violating the law. And this notion that we wouldn't exercise this plenary power that Congress has to, number one, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the lower courts are created by Congress. So the lower courts, there's no doubt Congress could say, take away their jurisdiction to adjudicate cases defining marriage, you know, funding of Planned Parenthood, immigration enforcement, election laws and procedures in certain cases. It makes no sense that we wouldn't do this, because just look ahead to whatever your favorite policy is, why you want a Republican governor, Republican president. Just know it will be thrown out by the courts. That is happening now. States, you know, Republicans control 2/3 of the state legislative bodies, 31 governors. It's hard to get Republicans to do the right thing, but a couple states are doing good things. And the few that are, like in North Carolina, they're getting crushed. They're literally getting crushed in the most common sense things. The notion that a district judge or a circuit judge that's appointed by Congress, it's created, the institution created by Congress, the notion that they could just do what they want is and Congress cannot stop that is absurd. But even the Supreme Court, you know, the appellate jurisdiction can be regulated statutorily. I'm not going to go through all the quotes and everything. We're running out of time. But Chapter 9, I give the definitive kind of constitutional philosophical case why this needs to be done. I note that even Justice John Marshall said in the Virginia Ratifying Convention that these exceptions certainly go as far as the legislature may think proper for the interest and liberty of the people. He was responding to George Mason. Edmund Randolph, the first attorney general of our nation, you know, he left the Constitutional Convention because he was concerned about this very, you know, notion that the judiciary might usurp power. And he said he came back in the Richmond Convention. He said, oh, you know, I'm good. This is good. You guys should ratify this. My objection would be unanswerable were I not satisfied that it contains its own cure in the following words, quote, with such exceptions and under such regulations as Congress shall make. He concluded that he felt confident the cure of jurisdiction modification and judicial reform would obviate any dangers posed by judicial tyranny. Quote, Congress can regulate it properly, and I have no doubt they will. The only thing he got wrong is the notion that Congress would have the guts to do this. And, you know, again, I know there's been a lot of scholarly debates, law review articles written since the dawn of time on the concept of judicial review. But just a couple of words here to begin with. As Justice Marshall said, it was only in some cases. It was only when it was manifestly against the plain meaning of the Constitution. It was only to grant relief to that specific case. So, in other words, you know, if a state throws someone in jail, a fundamental right is asserted there. Hey, my liberty is being endangered. I'm in jail. Well, why are you in jail? Well, it's a state statute. They say, well, look, we got to ultimately look at the final arbiter, which is the Constitution. You know, and if we deem it unconstitutional, we're going to grant relief to that plaintiff. But the notion that you would have binding precedent on every political and social issue of our time, even if the courts would reasonably attempt to interpret the Constitution as it was adopted, even then, it's absurd. I mean, this is not the system of governance we adopted, a judicial veto. This council of revision was something posited by Madison, and they rejected it. And even then, it wasn't just the courts. It was a mixture of the president. It was in lieu of a veto. So you had some elected representation there. It wasn't stolen sovereignty. But to have a veto, so you have a governor on a state level, president on a veto, and now a second round, that any organization could just get standing to directly shoot at a statute. So again, there's one thing if you're thrown in jail for being a homosexual, so you petition a court. That's kind of Lawrence v. Texas getting into the anti-sodomy laws, but we're long done with those. You have North Carolina, a case where they passed a law just merely allowing magistrates to take their name off of it. And, you know, they're still going to get their same-sex marriage licensing. And yet, they now have standing in court to say, I'm offended that you, Mr. John Smith magistrate, are not going to be signing my – I mean, how do you get standing for that? But again, this is the system. This is what it's morphed into. But again, not to relitigate judicial review as much, just in an overarching way, to the extent one believes they were able to get that power, Congress could regulate that. And I just want to make one more point on this before we close. I don't like the term jurisdiction stripping because it connotes the fact that all things equal, the courts have the power. Unless Congress takes it away. John Marshall said the following. He said, when the first legislature of the Union in 1789 proceeded to carry the third article of the Constitution into effect, it must be understood as intending to execute the power they possessed of making exceptions to the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. It has not indeed made these exceptions in express terms. It has not declared that the appellate power of the court shall not extend to certain cases. But it has described affirmatively its jurisdiction, and this affirmative description has been understood to imply a negative on the exercise of such appellate power as it not comprehended within it. So in other words, he was saying that the courts only have the power that's granted to them. I mean, until 1914, the Supreme Court didn't have the power to overturn state Supreme Courts in all directions, whether they're upholding a federal statute or striking it down. And I mean, it's time our people at least understand this history, understand that that power exists. And whether we ultimately exercise this, but at least bringing it up, holding hearings, proposing legislation that, no, this is illegitimate, we could green light the states to start taking back power. Because I promise you all here, at some point that will have to happen. And I think that time is coming very close. Judge Robert Bork, in 1996 essay, he warned about this. He said, you know, we're never going to fix this baby. He didn't really like Article 3, Section 2 remedy at the time, but I wonder if he would change 20 years later, given what's going on. But he talked about civil disobedience, and he said it's the other side that's engaging in it, in civil disobedience. So these are all – this is discussed at length in Chapter 9 of my book. I give the historical, philosophical case for it. The imperative, why this, I believe this is really the only workable solution, how we could do it, the different political ways to do it. I also discuss another ancillary remedy of, you know, maybe shaking hands with the other side, not that they'd easily agree, but as a compromise, if you don't want to get rid of judicial review in certain cases, certain very important cases, at least modify the quorum, say that, you know, if you strike down a state law governing something so bedrock as religious liberty, sovereignty, immigration, at least you need unanimous ruling from the, you know, appellate court and, you know, 7-2 from the Supreme Court. I go through how they could do this. There's been a number of bills since the 1830s that have been introduced making this case. None have ever really gone anywhere. But, you know, a lot of people say, hey, you know, Daniel, you're a majoritarian. I know, you know, that was thrown at Scalia, it was thrown at Bork. But that's not a majoritarian because, you know, what a republic as opposed to a democracy means that the people get to decide either directly or indirectly. It just means you don't have a national legislature. You have the states, you have the three branches, and, you know, the people ultimately, who is the arbiter? Not the courts. It's the people. The people have to say that this is illegitimate because we have a constitution. Majority rule is not legitimate. But, you know, let's just say birthright citizenship. We have a fix that I advocate for in Chapter 4. I have the full case against mandated unqualified birthright citizenship for illegals, full case laid out in layman's terms. And, you know, let's say the Senate passes a law 51-49 to modify birthright citizenship, which, by the way, there is no law upholding prevailing understanding. It was born out of a laziness of the HHS, Social Security Administration, to really enforce it on the hospitals. Retroactively, they created a whole thing with Wong Kim Ark and, you know, saying it's mandated. But the point is that that's the prevailing practice. Let's say we pass it, 51-49. So you're going to say, Daniel, that's a majoritarian rule. All right, so now you have a court decision, 5-4, saying that the law is unconstitutional. So majoritarian rule of a elected body is bad, but majoritarian rule of an unelected body is good. So at least if we're going to do this, maybe we should have a discussion of, you know, at least have the court speak with one voice, where you don't have half the court saying, you guys are from Mars, I don't know what you're talking about, like in the marriage case. So, you know, it's at least show some balance. I know we're out of time here, so much more to say. I really appreciate everyone bearing with me. I just want to end with the following quote from one of my favorites, Justice Joseph Story. He said, let us never forget that our constitutions of government are solemn instruments addressed to the common sense of the people and designed to fix and perpetuate their rights and their liberties. They are not to be frittered away to please the demagogues of the day. They are not to be violated to gratify the ambition of political leaders. They are to speak in the same voice now and forever. They are of no man's private interpretation. They are ordained by the will of the people and can be changed only by the sovereign command of the people. Let's take back our system of governance and our constitution. Let's not let these demagogues take away the sacred document our forefathers founded and all signed in 1789. Thanks so much, everyone.
Daniel, thank you. Tim, you're going to open the floor for questions?
Yeah, absolutely. In just a second, everyone is going to hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. After that, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. and you'll join the queue, and we'll answer questions in the order in which they're received.
Thank you. And while I love the way she repeats your instructions. While people are getting lined up to talk to Daniel, let me just mention a few things, Daniel, that you and I talked about and you touched on. And for those of you on the call, you have just a taste of the breadth of the topics that Daniel covers in his book. For those of you who are members of the Administrative Law Practice Group, you'll recognize some of the themes in Daniel's book that we have focused on in prior conventions. Standing, for example, as a problem, the oddities of who will get standing and be able to challenge something and who will not. The dereliction of duty that our members of Congress have engaged in for so many years. And of course, what Daniel proposes in his book is that Congress clarify, as it is constitutionally authorized to do, that it clarify the jurisdiction of the courts. Something that has just gotten way out of hand to the points that courts have engaged in not jury nullification, but electorate nullification. A couple of decisions that the Supreme Court rendered after Daniel finished his book include Whole Women's Health, in which the Supreme Court decided that it knows better than the people of Texas what rules it wants to apply to abortion clinics to preserve and protect the health of women who go to them. In Stormans, the Supreme Court decided that it knew better than the people of Oregon, who decided that a pharmacist who did not want to dispense abortifacient drugs could refer someone who wanted them to somebody down the street who would provide them without violating his or her conscience. The Supreme Court decided that wasn't good enough. Religiously minded people who consider abortifacients to be terminating a human life have to provide them anyway. So Daniel touches on, what Daniel focuses on are the consequences of judicial tyranny and, at the end of the book, remedies for them. Daniel, do you want to, in fact, Tim, do you have, I was going to give Daniel another chance to say something, but let's first see if if we have some questions on the line.
We actually do have a couple questions queued up, and if you guys don't mind, we'll go ahead and go to the first one.
All right, with you, Daniel?
Sure.
All right, go ahead, caller. You have the floor.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPods, and we're facing a similar situation, but not about social issues, but about sovereignty over and the post-Roads restriction in the Constitution that would allow private entities to build sustainable infrastructure. And so you can look at Hyperloop or JPods or any of these companies. But the barrier is the federal government violating the post-Roads restriction, and it'd be really good to see the Federalist Society create a panel to help get standing for different efforts to nullify federal law that is unconstitutional, similar to the way MCI broke the federal communications monopoly.
That's interesting, but I'm not sure it really goes to Daniel's topic, does it?
I mean, just one thing I would speak more generally is this is part of the what. Before I launch into the judicial tyranny and the stolen sovereignty, I have one short chapter on Obamacare. So in other words, where most of the time we're on defense. It's the other side nullifying state laws or just basic practices since the founding of our country, social transformation, granting citizen rights to illegals, yada yada. But I start off with Obamacare was the big case where we went on offense. And that was, to me, had that gone the other way, you could say, hey, maybe there's usefulness into having a powerful eminent tribunal judicial veto, and at least we benefited from one of the worst policies from our vantage point. But that was the point. You talk about property rights. And the case, both in both King v. Burwell and in the individual mandate case, it wasn't about the efficacy of the law and the market forces and everything. That's a political issue. It was about whether you could coerce someone to engage in commerce, whether you could regulate in inactivity. And thus we had Chief Justice Roberts saying you can, and every Democrat appointee on the lower level and even a couple of Republican appointees ruled that way. And you're seeing that. So they don't protect property rights when it's legitimate. When there's a legitimate grievance, and that's the whole point. the fundamental rights that are there are not protected by the courts, and then the ones that don't exist and actually infringe upon real property rights, they create.
Right, and that's exactly the problem we're facing is that we have a real property right to exercise our patents, and the federal taxing to fund infrastructure violates the internal improvements restriction. And it applies to the whole idea of divided sovereignty, that the federal government is sovereign over issues of war and the path to war. But commerce, other than that leads to the path to war, is state sovereignty.
Yep, as Madison said in the Federalist Papers, anything pertaining to internal order. But yeah, I mean, we've moved way beyond that. So that's the thing. The same courts that crush the states and mandate all this new stuff, they're not going to defend them when they go on offense against the federal government for infringing upon property rights or overstepping their enumerated powers, because the same constitution that grants foreign nationals an affirmative right to immigrate and remain here against the national will and create a gay marriage is the same judiciary that doesn't read Article 1 as a document of enumerated powers.
I think we have time to take one more question from the audience, and then after that we will turn it back over to Daniel so we can have the final word. Just a reminder, the next scheduled Teleform conference call is a litigation update on crisis pregnancy centers and the First Amendment. That's going to be on Wednesday, September 21st at 3 o'clock p.m. Love for you to join us for that. And last question. Go ahead, caller. You should have the floor.
What makes you think that the same problems that you're addressing won't stop your solution? And I'll just briefly say what I mean by that. There's two ways. First, the Congress just doesn't do this because the Senate blocks any limitation on the court's jurisdiction over any hot button issue. Or two, they get it passed and the judges throw it out. I mean, if you're in a postmodern society where all the judges believe what legal academia believes, they'll just find a way around it and we'll be in a state where the rule of law is even more clearly attacked and nothing happens. And in other words, are you setting up a situation where we could really have a crisis, a constitutional crisis?
Well, that's a great question. That's the number one question I get asked. All right, well, the same guys will just say what you're doing is unconstitutional and your remedy is unconstitutional, and that's unconstitutional. I mean, the point is at some point you've got to bring it to a head. I would argue, when they're mandating transgenderism on a state, we kind of are in a constitutional crisis in many, many ways, that it's worse than one can imagine. So I think that's the point. You bring it to a head. There's a bunch of case law I go through Chapter 9 that made it very clear what the exemptions and regulation clause is. Now, you're right. Again, the same people that say on the underlying issue that the Constitution has flipped on its head, they'll flip Congress's power over the judiciary on its head as well. But at some point, you got to say no, and at some point, you got to force the issue. A big part of this is, again, it's not so much mechanically, all right, you take care of this issue, you get this issue out of the courts. I think by having this national dialogue through the platform of Republican control and a Republican president making this the issue will at least get on the table that there's some sort of pushback. There's some sort of – right now we're not even doing that. The understanding is whatever the court says, literally we'll pass a law and almost like, okay, you got a veto and then now let's go to the courts. Well, what do the courts have to say? And we gotta change that around. And I think that attitude alone will encourage the states to ultimately fight back. I mean, the other thing is, the biggest case I feel it's needed is immigration. I just feel because, the courts have been using the 14th Amendment to grant super rights to protected classes at the expense of unalienable rights of everyone. But now they're copying and pasting that and giving them to foreign nationals. This is the new rage in the courts, and it's really getting worse. And given, what's going on in the news, the security problems, we're going to have to make some decisions. And you had a lot of these debates over birthright citizenship, over the right of a nation to exclude a class of people, which is very simple. But these the legal profession, a lot of these people believe that a nation doesn't. So I believe that needs to be addressed. And I think I'll just give you an example. With birthright citizenship, what I write about, you could attack that from four different angles. It's a complete enumerated power, Article 1, Section 8 of Congress. You have the Congress, you have the question about the role of the court to begin with. Then you have Congress's ability, Article 3, Section 2, to strip them. And then also, what I do advocate on several things, and it applies to the social issues, the election laws too, is there is Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Section 5, that little clause there, gives Congress, not the courts, Congress the power to enforce the 14th Amendment over the states. And, you know, in Katzenbach v. Morgan, 1966, the court said that this is a positive grant of legislative power authorizing Congress to exercise its discretion in determining whether and what legislation is needed to secure the guarantees of the 14th Amendment. So, I mean, it's really a dual track. They could attack it from both angles. Say, wait a minute, this is not what the 14th Amendment means. Here's what it means. Oh, and by the way, Article 3, Section 2 gives us the power to regulate your jurisdiction anyway. And again, even if we don't want to start with the Supreme Court, at least the lower courts are basket cases, because as you've, you know, Eileen mentioned with the, you know, the case in Washington State with the pharmacy, religious liberty, you know, the Supreme Court didn't grant cert. So upheld the lower court's ruling. We're seeing this all the time. So at least taking away the lower court's ability to encumber every common sense state religious liberty law, Immigration Enforcement Act, Federal Enforcement Act in the courts for 5 years, we'll lose 60% of them. Even the ones we wind up winning in a defensive victory will be fleeting, and it will take years and tons of money to defend. At least make it that the court just, all right, NAACP, ACLU, you want to hit at this? You got to go straight to the Supreme Court. I mean, there is no scholarly argument to be made that Congress doesn't have that power. That's beyond the shadow of a doubt. So I think all those together, you know, you don't go from zero to 100. You're not going to pass one judicial reform bill stripping the Supreme Court of 10 major issues in one shot. But I mean, I think this needs to be started at some of the critical issues that people believe the electorate needs to decide. Maybe you start with the lower courts, and you at least have that dialogue. I, you know, if we don't try, we're never going to succeed. And I'll tell you this much, it's sure as heck a lot easier than passing a constitutional amendment, as hard as it is, to get three quarters of the states to adopt that. You know, everyone's saying we need a Republican president to help protect the courts. I would argue we need a Republican president and Senate to reform the courts.
Thank you.
I agree so much. You know, Daniel, one of the things that we haven't mentioned is the fact that your book compares and contrasts your recommendation for remedies with Mark Levin's recommendation in his Liberty Amendments. His remedy is a very long-term one. Yours is a remedy that can be enacted with a Congress that is willing not to be derelict in its duty.
No, absolutely. And just real quickly, I mean, I go through, you know, I talk about remedies of immigration remedies that steal the sovereignty of the people, chain migration, illegals being counted in the census, big problem, non-citizens voting, automatic birthright citizenship, dual citizens voting in foreign elections. There's a lot of very systemic problems in the electorate. And then I tackle religious liberty. I believe those are the most systemic issues facing us, that if we don't deal with them, A, we won't have a nation state, we won't have an electorate that we could even use to win with other policy issues, and then we won't have the whole founding of our country, which was religious liberty. We are literally criminalizing Christianity. The sexual identity movement has become almost a national religion. By the way, I make the case in the book how they are the ones who violate the Establishment Clause. What they always accuse the religious communities of doing, they're the ones doing that by mandating, coercing at the force of law. This has to be dealt with. But again, anything you want a state or even Congress to do on those fronts, I guarantee you, if nothing is done to educate people that the courts don't have this power or to take away that power, the courts will strike down everything we're doing. Keep in mind right now there's a Democrat president. Were there to be a Republican president and 30 Republican governors, we will only be playing defense in the courts.
Right. And as you point out, there is a ratchet effect. The left continues to fight and fight and fight until it wins. And the right, when the left wins, says, okay, that's the status quo. We're just going to try to prevent further losses, further incursions on our liberties. And you're encouraging us all to take affirmative action, if you'll forgive the expression, to limit the judiciary's ability to overrule the will of the people.
No, exactly. It's literally, as hard as this is, it's a question of, you know, could you take back Gaza or Pakistan and Waziristan block by block, mountain by mountain? It's never going to work. And there's got to be some systemic way to take this out, because the bottom line with the courts is that they just, even the victories, like I said, they're defensive victories. It's more a matter, we got enough of a Republican panel that didn't yet want to go there. But it's
right.
Still keep built
it,
upon so
keeping
many levels.
It yeah. worse, not good enough.
Exactly. So that's my underlying message. Everyone's saying the courts hang in the balance, Republican or Democrat. We're going to lose the courts one way, win the courts the other way. I just don't believe that to be true. I believe fundamentally we've lost the courts a long time ago, and we need to, at least concurrent with this discussion of appointing better judges, concurrently look at a broader package of judicial reform. And I hope this really spawns that, at least a dialogue over this issue that's long overdue.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us today, Daniel. Your book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming the Country, is just fabulous. I read you as often as you write on Conservative Review and other places where you are where you're published. Tim, do you have any administrative comments that you'd like to wrap up with?
I just want to thank the two of you again on behalf of the Federalist Society for joining us today. One more programming note. Again, please join us Wednesday at 3 o'clock for our litigation update on crisis pregnancy centers. Although I'm sure there's much more that could be said about this great book. Again, just thank you both, and thanks to our listeners and callers.
And a podcast will be available, what, in a day or two, or before that?
We're shooting for tomorrow, but yes, the podcast will go up on the regular podcast page.
Fantastic. So for people who want to make sure that they can share this with friends who weren't able to dial in, let's look for the podcast link.
That's right. Again, thanks very much, and until Wednesday, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.